Accession number 12368, reel 5.
Mr. Clark, reel 5.
After that, we proceeded along the Danube to as far as the village of Ensford on the River Enns. There the war, as I say, ended for me. We met the Russians there. They came to a dinner in which the American Corps commander, General Walker, feted the Red Army general. The day after, I and American CBS correspondent, Larry LeSueur, tried to get to Vienna. We got to the town of San Puelten, some 20 miles from Vienna, where we were stopped by a Russian lieutenant general and kept alone and without food or water for the rest of the day before being escorted back to Ensford. Because in a way, of course, we had seen how weak the Red Army were. The German 6th Panzer Army had been able to withdraw almost out of contact with the Russians and to surrender to the Americans. The war is ended.
You, I think, also did some reporting from the Nuremberg trials.
Yes.
Can you tell me how that came about? Well, were you sent that by a newspaper?
I was going to say, there was a little... am I on?
Yes.
There was a little episode. Did you remember the officer in the tower, Bailey Stewart?
Yes.
Should I tell that episode? In the days when the war stalled or ended, we used to make excursions up into the Tyrol. We came one day. Still, the place was still thronged with German SS troops who had not yet been taken into captivity, and we got to the village of Bad Altsee. We made for the Rathaus there to find it surrounded by Austrians who were all trying to get into the main entrance. We forced our way through and got to the mayor's chamber, which was also completely crammed with people. And there, sitting at the desk, was an American major who had been parachuted into the area towards the end of the war and had taken up a position as town major. Here he was, with his feet on a very ornate desk, his fingers being manicured by a girl. There was a three-piece orchestra in the corner, and there was somebody drawing his profile. While we talked to him, and he suddenly saw that I was, as he put it, a limey. I said, I picked up one of your chaps the other day. I said, what was his name? And he rummaged him out among the papers on the desk, found a piece of paper in which were the words, Bailey Stewart, spelt wrongly, BailleyStewart. So I immediately was alerted by this, because in fact, in the days when Bailey Stewart was an officer in the tower, I, as a young reporter on the News Chronicle, used to go along to watch him take his daily exercise, so I knew who he was. So we asked if we could see him, and we were told we could. and we were taken along to the local jail, and inside a cell there was Bailey Stewart, dressed in Tyrolean costume, a green, what do they call it? There's another word for this.
The bib.
That doesn't matter. It's a particular kind of cloth. Dressed in Tyrolean costume with a jacket with deer's teeth hanging from it, in lederhosen, and with these halbhosen, these socks that leave the back of the leg bare. He was very affable and very, very forthcoming. He was a drug addict. He was drugged up to the eyeballs, and was complaining that he'd been wrongly arrested. He had in fact been arrested for mistranslating the statement of an Austrian. He was caught out in this, and he had explained that he was not, as we in England believed, an assistant of Lord Haw Joyce, but he had joined the, when he had returned to Germany after serving his imprisonment in England, he had joined the Goebbels propaganda machine. He had helped with some of Lord Haw's broadcasts, but he'd taken exception to their line of propaganda and left. And he had since that time led a very aimless life with an Austrian countess in Austria. He was put on trial in this country subsequently, but he was, unlike Joyce, who was hanged, he was acquitted because at the time of his anti-Allied activities, he was in fact... He had in fact already taken out naturalisation papers to become a German, so he was in effect legally not a British citizen.
What was the name of this place? Bad.
Bad Aussee. AUSSEE. It's the home. It's the birthplace of Liszt. And it was one of the Austrian Emperor had a lodge there. It was a lovely, beautiful place.
How long were you with Bailey Stewart?
Only for an hour, I suppose. Yeah. The village was en fête because although the war was, the war didn't seem to matter up there. They were putting on a music festival, which was the important thing to them. They're all thronging this place to try and get tickets for it. After that, I returned to England for a short spell. I did, in fact, throughout the war, and I was away for something like 4 years, I did, in fact, only have two leaves of 5 days each. Every time I came home, the balloon seemed to go up, and I would be sent back very pronto. So my wife had a pretty lean time of it.
To tell me about the
Nuremberg. It's before that. Just a little bit about war correspondence, and that is that it's people have got perhaps a false idea of war correspondence. There are some who are with the troops, but as likely as not, a great many of them remain at headquarters and file their dispatches from there. As I've indicated, in fact, half a dozen or 10 people at the most war correspondents were in the desert, and even fewer in other actions. Although in Europe, for instance, the American Third Army had 40 correspondents, more or less, in the field. Now, as for danger, there are occasions in which I've been four or five occasions I can think of, and when I've been on the as near as death as anything, on one occasion we'd gone into the the town of Trier, which is Marx's birthplace, among other things. And we'd gone in by a dogleg, still heavy fighting there, and the Germans on both sides of us. But we got into the town, and as correspondents we were going through from house to house, we were allowed to, we used to help intelligence by seeking out any letters we might find that might help in some way or other, giving them to the intelligence. And I was with a CBS cameraman named Cuthbertson. And we rummaged around in the front room. Looting was very scrupulously prohibited by the Americans. There were men shot for it. But we were allowed to, as correspondents, to collect paper or typewriters or pencil, anything of that sort. Things that would maintain us in our advance. But as we'd rummaged around in this front room, and Cuthbertson started to walk from the front room to the room behind, when out of it came a German with a Panzerfaust in his hands. Now, a Panzerfaust is an anti-tank weapon, rather like a long drain pipe. And he stuck this into Cuthbertson's tummy, and I can still see hear his reaction. He said, "Ooh!" That's all he said. The German dropped the Panzerfaust, seeing there were two of us in the room, I think, and gave himself up. Now, that's as near as I've been. I've sniped at quite a lot in various places, but the nearness of correspondence to the action, it's a strange business. But whereas the soldier is in the line for a certain time, the war correspondent in the field is up there all the time. And part of the difficulty, I always found it much more comfortable to be in the front line than to be having to go up through the communication lines, which were usually the ones that were under fire, and seeing the damage that they could do. At one time in the desert, we had in fact sustained 44% casualties as a unit. Not all of them killed, or quite a few of them killed, but a good many of them taken prisoner, South Africans, for instance. But there were three or four of my News Chronicle correspondents who were killed in the war, lost. But at the same time, you asked earlier on about fear, but it's a funny thing. You do get immune to it, you know. You're there out of interest.
Curiosity.
Absolutely. Yes. But I can remember another chap going in on the at Anzio in the assault craft, and I tried to talk to the soldier beside me. He was absolutely unable to open his mouth. He was so frightened. And I could understand, you know, probably not been in it before.
This was an American soldier.
No, this was a British soldier. I was with the British 2nd Brigade there.
Who was the brigadier whom you said you landed with at Anzio?
And I Brigadier Penny. P-E-N-N-E-Y. What else? Berlin? I went into Berlin, but I wasn't... we didn't get into Berlin until about a month after the end of the war, you know.
What did you see in Berlin?
Oh, I saw all the ruins. I'll give you a cheap... I was going to say, before I go, I'll give you, let you handle a copy of Mein Kampf, which I actually picked up from Hitler's bedside in the bunker. I don't know what it's worth. I mean, the trouble is that I can't say it's his copy. I can only say that I, in fact, picked it up there.
you see in the bunker?
Well, it was then pretty well stripped because, as I say, we got in about a month after the Russians had been there. To get to it, it was flooded and full of mosquitoes. And one part I had to get on top of a table and propel myself along the corridors to get to Hitler's bedroom. And I also got a coat hanger from his wardrobe. It's a very simple sort of room, very small. Oh, it's from just about to that door there. That's about all. When we got to Berlin, we could still see the jerry cans which had contained the petrol that was poured over his body and Eva Braun's before they were burned. But Berlin was devastated in a way that London never knew.
How were the Russians behaving then?
Oh, like vultures, I think you might say. They were looting everything they could, and there was a black market got set up near the Brandenburger Tor, and they were doing all sorts of deals there. Every Russian soldier seemed to have a briefcase which he put was buying up these things. Things like bicycle tubes, for instance. You'd see girls who'd got bicycle tubes around their tummy, undressing more or less to having bartered it with for cigarettes and whatnot to the Russians. No, you see, I'm not the one really to tell the Berlin story. Or Forrest, maybe. I think Forrest got there a bit earlier than I did.
So, can we go on to Nuremberg?
Yes, now? Yes. At the end of 1945, having had a short leave back home, I was sent out to cover the Nuremberg trial, which I did from beginning to end. It was quite a strange experience to walk into this theatre-like courtroom with tiers of upended seats for the press to occupy. The particular seat I was allotted was, in fact, only about 6 or 10 feet from Goering and his seat as number one prisoner in the dock. The first impression you got really was what a puny lot they were. There were people who could be ordinary bank clerks or small tradesmen. Goering used in the morning, I had a couple of row of medals by that time. He used to see me. He was, of course, had all his medals taken from him, and he used to bow to me, thinking I was somebody of importance. So this went on every day for about 8 months. The other thing that's forgotten about Nuremberg was that not only were these big main charges indicted against the Nazis, but in each case there was an individual case in which they had participated in the murder of a particular person, so that it was not just they would have been hanged on that or not, as the case may be, on that one charge.
You were telling me earlier off the record that one particular British representative played the key role. Can you just repeat what you told me then?
Shawcross and...
About the one who became the Scottish peer.
Yes. The big British figure at Nuremberg was in fact was Maxwell Fife, who later became Lord Kilmure. He was a tremendous cross-examiner. In fact, on one occasion when the prosecution of Goering was left to the to an American lawyer. I've forgotten his damn name. But Goering was got him into a real tangle and was scoring points off the prosecution. At this point, the Maxwell Fife jumped up, and by very penetrating questions, succeeded in getting admissions from Goering, from which he was never able to recover. It was really a question, I suppose, not of the American being inadequate, but of the fact that Maxwell Fife had a much closer knowledge of all the Nazis' misdeeds, both before and during the war. Of the others, Goering was the only figure who stood out among this, as I say, puny lot. There wasn't a single one that really made any impression on anybody who watched the proceedings. On the bench, the big figure there again was Sir Norman Burkitt. Judge Lawrence, who was the chairman of the tribunal, was often lost his place, but it would be Norman Burkitt who would bring the court back to the real point of the matter.
Did you feel that the trial was conducted fairly?
I did indeed. I think it was the fairest that could have been devised. Everything was exposed. The Germans, of course, had this immense liking for documents, and documents were produced in their hundreds. Day by day, there was a great load of documents would be filed in which they implicated themselves or implicated others.
Photographs.
We even had on one occasion, when it came to the question of the trial of the July the 20th plotters against Hitler, the bomb plot, when a film was shown which the Germans themselves had made. It lasted for 4 hours, and showed the whole proceedings of hanging the bomb plotters. This was at Plötzensee prison in Berlin, and they were each hanged from meat hooks. As they were strung up, there was all these jackbooted Nazis clicking their heels and drinking a toast. There was a trestle table which was covered in glasses full of schnapps. In one case, I remember seeing one of the Nazis pull down the trousers of one of the hangmen on the film.
Did Speer make any special impression?
Yes, he did. He was rather a technical man. I think he probably got away with it through his own brilliant mind as much as anything, because clearly he was implicated in the slave program. But Although he was sentenced to imprisonment, I think, for 12 years, I remember the day after the hangings, we were taken around the... I and three or four others were taken round the cell block by Colonel Andrews, who was the American jailer, and we looked through the peephole into Speer's place, and he was most affable and spoke good English. On that score, the night of the hangings is perhaps, well, wait a minute, before that. The last day of the when they were sentenced to death, there was a great throng there, of course, that day, and each of the defendants was brought into the court alone, and stood at a little side table, while he was. Had the sentence delivered. Goering was the first to come out through a panel in the door behind the dock, and he stood there, a very much frailer figure than he appears in most of his photographs. And Lord Justice Lawrence spoke to him and said, Hermann Goering, on the charges of the indictment on which you have been found guilty, you are sentenced to death by hanging. Goering threw his hands around. He had heard nothing. The headphones at which he was to hear the sentence delivered in translation caused a fault. So the American technician put the thing right, put on his ears again, and the sentence was delivered for the second time. And Goering just ripped the headphones off his head and flung them to the ground and marched out, and the sliding door slid to again. And they each came out one by one to hear their fate. Now, on the night of the hangings, again, because I'd been there so long and knew Colonel Andrews, the jailer, well. There'd been a lot of speculation about when the hangings would take place, and all the world's press were congregating in the castle of Schlossstein where we were billeted. But Andrews took me and three or four others aside and said, "No, it's not going to be a midnight hanging. It's going to be at 8 o'clock in the morning on such and such a date, 16th, I think, October 16th. Anyway, people got the general idea that it was going to take place that night. So everybody was away at the Palais de Justice, where the hangings were to take place, in the gymnasium of the cell block, which had been used as a netball pitch for the American guard. And he told us that it would be 8 o'clock on the 16th. Everybody else went up there, and in the rain, very cold, rainy night, we stayed behind at the Schloss